You're listening to The Inquiry on the BBC World Service with me, Helena Merriman. Each week, one question, four expert witnesses, and an answer. It's morning in Geneva, in Switzerland, and 17-year-old Nicola is walking towards one of the most intimidating buildings she's ever seen. She's got butterflies in her stomach. She's never done anything like this before. She walks up an avenue lined with flags, and there it is, the United Nations. And here she is, about to enter it, a child labourer from Peru. Nicola started working on the streets aged 8. She would scavenge for paper and plastic bottles and sell them to recycling plants, and she'd sell flags with her aunt at her local market. She's worked like this ever since she can remember. And now, along with other child labourers, she's bringing a message to the UN. Let us work. In an interview with us afterwards, she explained why.
Cuando supe que era una niña trabajadora, me sentí muy orgullosa y muy digna, porque supe que...
When I first realised I was a working girl, I felt very proud, she told us. Most people who see a child working think they've been exploited. But it's not always like that, she says. I would give the money to my parents and they would give me food, clothes, everything. It was my contribution to my family. It's inhumane to stop us working. She's one of thousands of children who've joined movements all over the world, demanding the right to work, challenging the ban on child labour. And they're not the only ones. Campaigners and researchers are also questioning whether the ban is working. It's a view you don't hear much. In fact, in making this programme, we spoke to people from some of the world's most respected NGOs who criticise the ban in private, but not in public. So this week, we're wading into a controversial debate, asking, is it time to rethink the ban on child labour?
Part 1. Lifting the burden.
I had the chance to do some traveling in college, and I think was exposed to children shining shoes, selling newspapers in the streets. And it wasn't until I continued my studies that it really dawned on me that what I was witnessing was child labor.
That's Benjamin Smith, senior officer for child labour at the ILO, the International Labour Organization that's part of the UN. It's the driving force behind the international ban on child labour, which it defines as...
work that jeopardizes children's development and future.
And there are two parts to this. One which bans what's known as the worst forms of child labour.
Slavery, use of children in prostitution and pornography, the use of children in illicit activities like drug trafficking, and then hazardous work that jeopardizes the health and safety or morals of children.
That's the uncontroversial part of the ban, and almost 200 countries have signed up to it. What's debated is the age at which children should be allowed to do work that isn't considered hazardous. Most governments have agreed to set the minimum age at 15 or 14 for some developing countries.
So children can enjoy their right to go to school until that minimum age for work. And then if they choose to carry on with their education, great. They also have the option to work. But work below that age, our evidence shows, inevitably interferes with children's education and really jeopardizes their future prospects, in fact.
And that's the main argument for the ban. Benjamin Smith says that by making child labour unlawful, you make it more likely a child will go to school than work. And the ban isn't just about paid work, it's about household chores too. If a child is fetching water or firewood for her family for hours on end and that's stopping her going to school, well, that's child labour too. But we know that there are millions of children around the world who do work, well below the ages of 13 and 14. Some of them are forced to do it, but many of them, like Nicola, who you heard from at the start of this programme, choose to do it to support their families. So why shouldn't they have that choice?
I think that that is placing the burden on children themselves in places like Uganda, where HIV-induced child labor is pretty widespread and they're orphans and they're obliged to work. Legalizing that work is not the solution. What needs to be done is that the government puts in place social protection measures so that those children can get the help that they need.
And that's the strategy the ILO has gone for, banning child labour while pushing governments to support families so children don't have to work. So has the strategy worked?
Well, the global numbers are moving in the right direction. From 2000 until 2016, we've seen a 38% decline in child labour globally. There were 152 million child labourers in 2016.
I suppose another way to look at this would be to say that here we are 50 years on from the ban and yet 152 million children are still in child labour. So do you think it's worth rethinking it?
I think that although we have seen a dramatic decline, it's not fast enough. I don't think we need to, you know, go back and consider revising definitions. What's needed is more resources, more political will, and a smart mix of policies that can get the job done.
In other words, keep going, stick to the ban, and with more money and buy-in from governments, we'll get there. But there are some who disagree. They say it's time for a radical rethink.
Part 2. Why work can work.
I've worked across many countries, Peru, Egypt, Bangladesh, Somaliland, many other places. I've worked with children on the streets, children in farm and factory work, and children who are in refugee camps.
That's Professor Joe Boyden from the Department of International Development at Oxford University. She's been researching child labour for decades. She was in Bangladesh 25 years ago when it emerged that children there were working in factories, making clothes for the American retailer Walmart. A US senator, Tom Harkin, proposed a bill banning imports of any products made by children. It got buy-in from the highest levels, including then-President Bill Clinton.
Today we are embarking on a new partnership. I hope that it will become a vital part of the battle against sweatshops here in the United States and against abusive working conditions, and particularly child labor, everywhere in the world.
And when the Garment Manufacturers Association in Bangladesh heard of this ban, they immediately threw the children out of their work. And something like 50 to 60,000 children were made redundant overnight.
50 to 60,000?
Yes, it was a very large number.
Joe Boyden went to some of the factories and interviewed the children who worked there, mostly young girls. And then she carried out a study, following what happened to the girls next.
Basically, the rationale behind Senator Harkin's bill was that by banning children's work, they would then be going to school. And the follow-up study that was done with a subsample of the children, it didn't find a single child that was able to attend school. Many of them ended up in much more dangerous alternative occupations.
Such as?
Some had gone into prostitution, working on the streets, brick chipping, which is a really dangerous occupation. And these alternative occupations were really more hazardous than in the garment sector.
She's not saying these factories were perfect. Far from it. Days were long and pay was low. But the girls worked together. Now they were on their own.
At least in the garment sector, there was the potential to work with employers to improve conditions. Even, for example, schooling within the context of the factories.
By pushing for a total ban, they lost the chance to improve the working lives of those children. That's one of the reasons she wants a rethink. But there's something else too. Something she discovered through a research project she's been working on for 16 years, involving 12,000 children in Ethiopia, India, Peru, and Vietnam. Through interviews and surveys, she says they discovered that many of them combine work with education, using the money from their jobs to pay for school books and uniforms. And what surprised her is how some of these children talk about their work. They don't all see it as a burden. Some take pride in it.
We've got lots of transcripts of interviews with parents and children alike. Children are growing in their sense of responsibility. So there are lots of life skills that you can't teach in schools. And what I see with children in poor countries who are working is a very gradual entry into work. They've already got a lot of the skills needed. They already know how to manage money. They know how to sell stuff and so on. In contrast, when you look at young people growing up in rich countries, they leave school age 18 and they have absolutely zero life skills. In many cases, they can't even change a light bulb.
They may not be able to change a light bulb, but by staying in education longer, their earning prospects will probably be higher. Children who combine school with work might find it easier to get that first job, but if they've missed huge chunks of their education, surely that's damaging in the long run.
Yes, I would agree with that. But a lot of organisations romanticise education as if it was all positive and good. Many of these young people are accessing very low quality schools, very low quality education. Many of them repeat grades frequently. Many of them fail to do their exams.
But isn't the answer there to improve education, not to make it easier or not to be more lax when it comes to children in work?
I think you do both. I don't think they're mutually exclusive. You just can't ban work overnight while families are still in poverty. It's the poorest children who work, and it's the poorest families whose incomes are most fragile.
So should we rethink the ban on child labour? Joe Boyden says yes. In countries where there's little support for poor families, the ban has pushed children into more dangerous jobs. And for many children, the money they get from working is the only way they can go to school. But when they look back on their childhoods, a childhood dominated by work, some feel they've been cheated.
Part 3. Following the harvest.
I can't remember the first time I was in the fields.
It was that young?
It was that young.
That's Zulema Lopez. She grew up in the US and started working with her family, picking crops, at the age of 7. The toughest work was harvesting cucumbers, she says. They had to work all day in a 35-degree heat.
We wake up early, around 5 o'clock in the morning, because we want to beat sunrise. We want to get as many hours as we can without the sun shining on us.
And would you have many breaks?
Breaks, we took breaks whenever we wanted, but the more breaks you took, the less money you made, the less contributions you brought to the family.
The days were long too, sometimes up to 15 hours. And it was tough work, particularly for a 7-year-old.
I remember rocks hurting my knees when I was bent over trying to, you know, work in the cucumber. I remember scratches on my legs when I worked in Texas under some crazy heat. The coldness, harvesting apples.
And was there a time of year when you wouldn't work?
I know there was consistent work the entire time.
Work that didn't leave much room for school. When the family needed more money, she'd take more time off school so she could earn more. And when the family moved to follow the crops, she'd move with them. One year, she changed school 4 times and she did badly in her exams. But through it all, she thought this was normal. It wasn't until a filmmaker made a documentary about her that she realized she was different from other kids.
And to see a room filled with about 1,500 people and they're all looking at your story, it was mind-boggling. It was crazy that I was bringing awareness to something that I didn't even know was a problem. And then that's when I realized that it was a problem and that the way I was living was not the way everyone lived.
That was the first time she heard the term child labourer, and she realized it described her. That was 7 years ago. Now she has made it to university, where she's an activist on child labour, campaigning in support of the ban.
I definitely feel like children shouldn't be able to work until the ages at least of 16. I think this is dangerous for the safety of these children and their education. And I know there's a lot of people like me out there.
Some people say, well, surely it's all right if someone goes to school and just does a couple of hours in the evenings or perhaps a couple of hours at the weekend to help give them income. Wouldn't that be all right?
It's definitely debatable. I know these families want their children to work to bring some income in, but they're just hindering their education. And I think that these families also need to find a different way to get around their situation.
Do you think you would have been able to go to school if you and your siblings hadn't worked?
Oh, absolutely. My two younger sisters still live at home. They've never felt like they've had to go out in the field to work. And that's because, you know, my family moved on to a different type of job that provided more for us.
So it sounds like you're saying it's almost as though you need to protect these children from bad choices they might make for the best reasons.
Right. I feel like these children shouldn't feel obligated. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. When Zulema was little, she felt she had to work. She felt responsible, even at the age of 7. And so she says more should be done to lift that responsibility off the shoulders of children like her and onto their parents to find another way. The ban helps do that. That's her argument. But for some of the poorest families in the world, there is no other way. What then?
Part 4. Work we can and cannot do.
In India, we have been able to actually create villages which have been child labor free by addressing all of the issues in a very comprehensive manner. It is possible to create communities where exploitative labor of children simply goes away.
That's Kavita Ratner. She's been working on child labour issues in India for the past 30 years, and she's now Director of Advocacy and Fundraising at Concerned for Working Children. That's a charity that works in Bangalore, a charity that says the ban on child labour isn't working.
There is a lot of pressure in countries like mine to insist there is no child labour anymore in most sectors, certainly in export sectors. The idea is to say that these products are clean, they're not touched by hands of child labour.
Because if they're seen as connected with child labour, they won't get any money for them. They won't be able to sell them.
Exactly. We don't even acknowledge their presence.
So when the authorities come across child labourers, she says that instead of helping them, they want them to disappear.
And here, if children are found working, the state response is come in white vans, put them in and take them away to childcare homes where they're locked up. The children are away from their families. And the state calls the family and tells them the child should never ever be seen like this again.
And when they're released, most of the children go back to work because the problems that drove them to work in the first place haven't been solved. And this is where Kavita Ratner's organisation comes in. They meet child labourers in their villages and ask them, not their parents, why they work. Some talked about the hot meal they get at the factory. Some said they didn't get the support they needed at school. Others said they had to look after their younger siblings or fetch water. All of them had different reasons. But they had one thing in common.
They were not willing to transfer their burden onto the family. For instance, if they were fetching water, they were not okay with saying, let your mother fetch water and you be in school, because they were saying, my mother has a lot to do already.
They had to find solutions that wouldn't put more pressure on their parents. And so Kavita Ratner's charity turned to what's known as the panchayats, India's local councils.
And a lot of the work of my organisation has been to work with these local governments, with children sitting with them. And the solutions in one case can be a scholarship for a child who has no money.
It could be more funding for childcare, so children don't have to look after their younger siblings.
In another case, a wheelchair for another child. In another case, it can be getting electricity for households which don't have it. And that is how we were able to create child labour-free communities in a country like India.
And by labour-free, she doesn't mean these are communities where no children work. What she means is that the work they're doing no longer interferes with school. Like Jo Boyden, she says some work can be a good thing. It gives children useful skills and money for textbooks or school uniform.
It's all about making sure they can choose the right kind of work. And to do that, they create children's councils.
I'll give you an example. The villages we work with, we talk to children and we actually come out with a document called Work We Can and Cannot Do. For instance, milking the cows. Most of us might think it's okay, harmless, etc. But these kids said, if you are milking what are called Jersey cows, which are very temperamental and which are very happy kicking, they said nobody should be doing it because it's harmful work. It's dangerous.
Instead of lists drawn up by international organisations or central governments, they find out what the children want. Some might be exhausted by hours of household chores and prefer to spend 2 hours working for a local shop. Others might choose factory work over milking a temperamental Jersey cow. It's down to them, and it gives them a lot of control over their own lives. But can you really expect children to make the right decision for themselves?
I'm yet to find a child who willingly wants to be exploited.
But a child who perhaps continues to work because they feel the pressure to help their family.
We have to give the child that choice. In fact, this kind of work actually increases our responsibility. When we are working with children directly, you don't let them take that one decision and then forget them. You're still in touch with them. You're part of their life.
They're now working with children's councils throughout Bangalore. It's time-consuming and expensive, but it's having results. So, is it time to rethink the ban on child labour? The ILO, the organisation behind the global ban, says no. Children under a certain age should never work. But we've heard about the unintended consequences. Children pushed into more dangerous work or locked up by the authorities. It's a debate that will continue. But when you take a step back, it's clear that the argument isn't just about policy. It's about something more fundamental. For some, particularly in the West, a child under a certain age who works is, by definition, being exploited. Others say a child should have the right to work. And that's what makes it so hard to know what's right. The answer doesn't lie in our definition of child labour. It's about how we view childhood. This inquiry was presented by me, Helena Merriman, and produced by Beth Sagar-Fenton. The researchers were Mengju Zheng and Terrell Amatsade. It was edited by Emma Rippon. Our production coordinator is Brenda Brown. And a special thanks to Alvaro Alvarez. And if you like this episode, please do leave us a rating or a comment wherever you get your podcasts. And finally, here's something about one of the latest podcasts from the BBC World Service, introduced by someone you might have heard of.
Hi, I'm Robert Redford. Where do you live?
Everybody there is good-looking, and they smell good, and they have chiseled jaws.
And what does it mean to you?
I thought Mumbai was going to be the city of my dreams.
The place, I mean, the neighborhood.
Everybody's kind to each other, whether you can speak their language or not.
Did you choose to move there?
This land was stolen from us. A flat-out, no questions, hands-down, stolen.
Neighborhood. A five-part series exploring how people live together.
Did you see the pumpkin over there?
It's humongous. Did you plant that?
A new podcast from the BBC World Service.
Here you'll find neighbours from all backgrounds.
Neighbourhood.
Every flag is represented here.
Find it wherever you get your podcasts.